Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Peters.
I'm here representing the Cincinnati Insurance Company, if it may please the court. We're here today moving into the commercial context of the banking relationship between a bank and its insurance carrier under a blanket bond. We're here on a summary judgment. There was no trial, and I'd like to address a couple of issues in connection with the summary judgment. One is the denial of summary judgment as to Cincinnati, and two, if time permits, the awarding of summary judgment in favor of the bank. The main issue I'd like to highlight here today has to do with the motion for summary judgment that was denied as to Cincinnati. We're dealing here essentially with two different insuring agreements of the bond insuring agreement D and E, both which relate to forgeries primarily, although there's some discussions of some counterfeiting here also. The bond itself covers the bank for certain types of losses it incurs by reason of forgery in certain types of documents. Cincinnati is not disputing that in one of the many documents that the bank obtained in connection with making these lease loan transactions that there was a forged signature, and that's what the definition of forgery in the bond is, the signing of the name of another with intent to deceive. So there's no dispute that there is a forgery. The dispute is whether the loss here incurred by the bank was by reason of the forgery.
You know, in support of your argument that Agreement E doesn't provide coverage, you drew a distinction in the briefs between documents that represent fictitious assets and other sorts of forged documents, right?
Absolutely.
If that's the distinction, why doesn't Agreement E at least apply to the 86 loans where there was a genuine enforceable typewritten lease in First National's files? I mean, was there some collateral for those loans?
Well, I think there is no precise typewritten lease that corresponds with the handwritten leases, the carbon copy of which was given to the bank. Each of the handwritten leases contains different terms and conditions in many respects. None of them are the same. Maybe a different borrower, maybe a different car, maybe a different description of the length of the lease term. In essence, you know, what the bank did is when the leasing company went out of business, they went in and took all their records over. In those records were some legitimate leases. Some of those leases were typewritten. What the bank did is they tried to compare the handwritten leases that don't exist and try to match them in some circumstances with some typewritten leases that were different.
Yeah, but suppose Cust had submitted two forged leases, one for a car that did not actually exist and one for a car that was already owned by someone else. Isn't it the forged signature on the leases that causes the loss in both situations, irrespective of whether the underlying asset is fictional or not?
I think if there was an actual transaction with an actual vehicle, and if the bank had accepted a false document that reflected that transaction, that's what the bond is supposed to address.
Well, help me here. If the loss, you may have helped me, but if the loss at issue is not caused by the forgery, can you give an example of a transaction where the loss would be caused by the forgery?
I think the transaction we were basically just discussing. If Lee Cust had an actual document, an actual transaction, had created a second version of that same document and signed the name of the person onto it, sold one to one bank, the real document, sold the fake to a second bank, then I think in that situation what the bond would say is the signatures are forgeries. The transaction reflected in the document is a real transaction. Therefore, the bank cannot reasonably be able to determine this is not a genuine document. A bank can determine, though, if the transaction doesn't exist at all. In that case, the bank could do its normal credit checks and references, and if it did, it wouldn't conclude that there was not a real transaction out here. It would be just that this bank didn't buy that transaction.
Well, would there be some way for that bank to learn that another bank had the same asset?
Well, I think that's the point of my arguments here is that if there is a transaction that's sold separately to two different banks, then it's reasonable to assume that that would be something the bond would apply to. If there's a non-existent transaction altogether, then the onus should be up on the bank to use its normal banking operations to figure out that the transaction doesn't even exist. In this case, they could have called up the lessees and found out the transaction didn't exist. They could have secured the collateral, which they did not do. They could have taken a proof of insurance on the items, which they were required to do under their loan policy, but did not.
None of that's required by the coverage language, though.
Well, the coverage language, if we, I guess, skip over to a second of the arguments, is the bond does require that the bank act in good faith and in the usual course of business.
Yeah, but if Cincinnati Insurance only wanted to insure losses that were caused by forgery, couldn't Agreement E have been drawn up to explicitly require that the forgery be the cause of loss?
And I don't want to indicate that I think that the argument we're making here is that the forgery is not only not a cause of the loss, the forgery is irrelevant to the loss. There could be situations, I suppose, where the forgery would be relevant. But here, it's irrelevant because the transactions themselves don't actually exist. Even if the forgery, if the names on the contracts were real and legitimate, the bank would be in the same situation it is now because the fact is there was no transaction, there is no collateral, and the bank testified ad nauseum that the vehicle itself was an important aspect of this transaction because Westtown did not have the financial wherewithal to support 20% of the consumer loans of the bank being issued to that entity.
But it was the presentation of the forged leases that brought about the respective draws on the line of credit. Isn't that factually the case?
Well, in reality, there was a lease line of credit that had a number of documents assigned to that. It was a personal guarantee by the Custs, a security interest in all their assets, as well as a mortgage on a building as security. Then each time there was an individual lease, there was a chattel, a mortgage, there was a assignment of the lease, there was a personal guarantee, and there was a note. So in reality, this lease agreement that had the forged signature was just one of many documents that was presented to them in connection with the loans.
What difference does that make?
I think it makes a difference because it's not like the bank was just accepting one document that had a forged signature on it. This was just one of the many documents that was presented to it in connection with the whole lease lending transaction that they had authorized.
But as a matter of the factual record, upon presentation of the forged leases, the bank would allow a draw against the line of credit.
I think
in that sense, the coverage language kicks in because the loss is by reason of the bank having extended credit or acted upon a document which is forged.
Well, I think all the cases that have addressed this particular issue in connection with totally fabricated transactions and non-existing assets, I guess, have disagreed with that position. We've got two appellate courts, four district courts, and two state courts who have said, in the context of a totally fabricated transaction, that the loss is not by reason of the signature. The loss is by reason of the fact that the transactions don't exist at all, and the signature is essentially irrelevant. It might have had some importance to the bank.
But the transaction wouldn't have occurred without the signature, would it?
Well, and I think that could be. I don't know if
that would be. Well, if you brought these things in blank, I wouldn't have been...
There is a question of whether one was brought in each time before loan proceeds were issued, and one has to question how, if these documents were so important and the signatures so important, why one would accept a carbon copy, basically, of the agreement instead of the actual agreement itself. So I think that is a disputed issue as to just how important these documents really were to the transaction, or whether it was the fact that there was an ongoing lending relationship with Lee Cuss that was a significant relationship to the bank that they wanted to continue because it was making money.
To follow up on that, as I understood it, there was about a 10-year relationship, and for many of the years, this thing didn't go south, and the problems happened near the end of the relationship. Is that accurate? Or?
Well, I don't believe that we didn't have a trial on this, obviously, so I don't believe that the record is necessarily clear as to how long he had been doing what he was doing.
Is it true that they had been doing business for about 10 years?
Yes, they had been doing business.
That's not a dispute.
Like 95
issue. But when was the first? I mean, the record. I don't know where this is in the record, but I'm sure it tells us somewhere where the first fraud, the date of the first fraudulent.
I think that
transaction.
Well, I cannot tell you the exact date of the fraudulent. Most of these leases were 1 to 3 year leases. And, you know, there's 160 of them. They would have varied over time, but I think the actual discovery of the problem was somewhere in, I think it was 2001. So there was...
So I mean, it's pretty clear here then that it was a number of years where business was done appropriately. And
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I don't. The bank records are not available. When we pulled the 1995 bank records, there are no leases in them at all.
Well, but if they were 2-3 year leases and they entered into them in the mid 1990s, those would have been long taken care of long before.
Correct, but I'm not sure that the record ever reflected that how many of those leases were real as opposed to turnover leases perpetrated by additional fraud.
Like a pyramid scheme or something?
I think a Ponzi scheme of sorts would be a good description, but I don't believe we ever got to exactly the bottom of where it all started. To some extent, we had to rely upon the testimony of the crook, which is always a difficult task because records were not readily available.
Nothing to do with the issues that were going to be working on in this case, but where is the crook today?
I believe he is actually serving some time now. But
he's been found.
Yeah, I think we lost some track of him. I originally interviewed him, and you know, he admitted that surprisingly that he is what he is, and I think he ultimately did spend some time.
Where was he when he admitted he is what he is?
Well, he disappeared, and that's when the first... first came up.
Right.
His wife called the bank.
After the bank had submitted its proof of loss, I did arrange to speak with Mr. Cust on the record. It was before the lawsuit was filed, but it was in law office up in Wisconsin. We did sit down with him and had a court reporter there and recorded his statement, and he did.
What kind of a guy was he?
You know,
we'll give you a few extra minutes.
My experience in bank fraud cases is that the kind of guys and women, because actually there are many, I think more women than men that do this. Believe it or not. But you know, they're usually
courageous
just
man. You really are. Are you not?
They're usually middle-aged, overweight guys with glasses. I mean, you know, who are personable, and people think, I'd like to have a drink with this guy. And I think he was similar in many respects to that. And that's, I think, why he was able to kind of sucker in my opinion, the bank people not to be so stringent on what their normal lending requirements would be.
Well, they were pretty stringent here, though. They made him come in personally, even though they had this long relationship, and it's just a little friendly bank up in Manitowoc.
Well, I think the difficult...
They knew most of the lessees here, didn't
well,
they?
I think that was an accusation that was not necessarily proved by the record. But, you know, I think that, you know, he, in our opinion, received a lot of benefits that other customers did not receive. And, you know, the second of the arguments I wanted to address was the fact that Cincinnati has been denied its ability to have a trial on whether the bank did in fact engage in good faith and in the usual course of business. And we think that there were a number of red flares that were right in the face of the bank at all times, including the fact that the security interests, the MV1s they were receiving that were supposed to reflect that they had security interests, were known to the bank to be wrong. And what did they do in connection with trying to address that and figure out what was going on? They asked him what's wrong, and he said, I'd fix it. And they never followed up. He never fixed it. So I think that's part of our argument, is even if this court does not accept the fact that losses based totally on fictitious transactions are not covered under the bond, we still should have had our day in court to show that the bank did not engage in proper banking procedures in connection with these loans.
It seems as if there's no Wisconsin precedent, you know, on the point. Do you think it's worth certifying to the Wisconsin Supreme Court the question of whether the banker's bond covers losses from loans?
Well, I guess I would hope that the Seventh Circuit would follow the lead of every other court that's addressed this issue, and that would not be necessary. And I think there's the reality of the banking relationship. This is not a contract created by the insurance industry. This is a joint industry item, and I think that's part of the reason all these cases have come down and said, you know, the bank has certain jobs it has to perform, and if they don't perform those jobs, then they need to suffer the risk. If it's something that they really couldn't have determined, like a document's fake, then a bonding company should step in.
This bond is no longer in use, is that right?
No, this bond is absolutely in use.
Hasn't it been replaced in the industry by the financial institutions bond, for the most part?
There are various revisions to the bond that have been, this is not part of the record, but various revisions have been made to the bond since its origin. There were 1980, 1983, 1985. The bond has progressed. Over time, some bond carriers have all the revisions, some bond carriers have part of the revisions. So this language is still in use by the Cincinnati Insurance Company and other carriers. So what the court does here today does have an implication on the industry as a whole, both the banking industry and the insurance industry.
So this insuring agreement E on forgery has corresponding provisions in the financial institutions bond that's
absolutely
wide use?
The language, I cannot tell you exactly what changes have been made to the language. There are some language changes in E that have occurred over the years. Some of them are included in here, and some of them, I think, are not.
And they include the in good faith and in the usual course of business language?
I believe that, again, I'm speaking not from the record, but I think that language remains.
Well, that's just a matter of legal research.
Yeah.
You know, you've eaten up your rebuttal.
I know. I certainly have.
Because We were so fascinated by Mr.
So I can have a minute or two.
We'll give you some.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Hello, Mr. Cade.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. What I'd like to do first, though, is follow up to the last question that Judge Sykes asked. The language in the Cincinnati bond is not the standard language. In fact, one of the things cited is financial institution bonds. I pulled this from the Marquette Law Library. And the language in there does not use usual course of business. That's Cincinnati's language. And I agree with Cincinnati that because the bond was formed both by the banking industry and the surety industry, you don't construe against the drafter. But that's the model draft. They added usual course of business. They don't define it. It's nowhere mentioned in the bond.
So we shouldn't read the language usual course of business to mean sound business practice because they're not necessarily the same.
I don't think they are the same. I think they've added a standard that they neglected to define. That's Cincinnati's problem. They should have corrected it, not turn around after the fact saying, oh, well, now we're going to set out a normative standard. That is not the bank's requirement. All that is required under the bond is that we act in good faith. Their 30B6 witness admitted we acted in good faith. The usual course of business, it's an undefined term. I think we should follow what Judge Griesbach did and said, what does a bank usually do? Well, it gives out loans. It accepts checks. It takes deposits. All of those things are the usual course of business, the things that we think of.
Everything went to hell here, it was just one telephone call that disclosed this whole fraudulent scheme, wasn't it?
No, I don't believe that's true, Judge Evans.
I thought they called, found a lease, and it was a non-existent
No, that's lease. Not the case. What had happened is when Mr. Coos went missing for a couple of days, his wife called around town.
She called the bank.
The bank was one of many places that she called, but she did call the bank. And after she called the bank, they started looking through some of their records, said, this doesn't look right. They asked Mrs. Kust, is it okay if we go look through Lee's records? Can we go to the offices? And she said yes. And when they went there is when they discovered there were some transactions that were more recent that they had. Well, those names don't match up. And that's when they pulled all the documents and all of their documents and started trying to match everything.
Are you denying, though, that the record supports that one telephone call disclose this fraudulent?
Well, I think the problem with one telephone call, Judge Evans, is the fact that the underlying persons were not the bank's customers. Those were Lee Coos's customers.
Yeah. Lee Coos. A lot of them were the same, though, weren't they?
Well, they were, but they were not coming to the bank for the loan. They were going through Lee Coos for the loan. And it didn't matter to the bank how he financed it. He could have financed it through the bank. He could have financed it. He did the same fraud through Associated Bank. So when he was sentenced, it was not only for the First National Bank, but for the Associated Bank fraud. I mean, that's a fourth largest bank in the state of Wisconsin, multi-business, billion-dollar operation. He did the exact same transaction. But the issue there is, in some of the transactions, he financed himself. So it's not a question of one call, because then it's the bank doing all of Lee's work. Okay, let me check with the customer. Is it true that you did this vehicle for this interest rate,
well,
for this dollar amount?
What policies did First National have in place to ensure that collateral for its loans actually existed?
Well, they did have a loan policy, Judge Rovner, and they did follow that loan policy. So for example, one of the things they collected were MV1s. Now, some of these MV1s were incorrect. There's no dispute about that. And they called that attention to Mr. Coos. But if you've ever seen a VIN number, you mistake one number in a VIN number, and it's going to get kicked back. And they called Mr. Coos, and it got taken care of. He said, you're right, maybe I transposed, I did something wrong.
Do we know how many times he did that?
I think that is in the record, John. I don't know it off the top of my head, but he did say, I will correct it. It's not a question of he said, you're right, you got me, this vehicle doesn't exist. There was an error somewhere, and it was corrected. It's not unusual for that to happen. It wasn't as if this was the only time in the history of the Wisconsin Department of Motor Vehicles that someone got an MV1 or wrote down the wrong VIN number. So that certainly wasn't enough to put the bank on notice. But the key to all of this is the insuring language. That's where we have to focus our attention. Good faith has been admitted by Cincinnati. The usual course of business is nowhere defined. And what's key is all of the cases that Cincinnati relies on, except for one, KW Bank Shares, every single other case uses the language that the loss is the direct result of the forgery. That's absent here. This bond does not say that. This bond does not say loss that is directly the result of. All that required is that we accepted a document, there was a forgery, and it caused a loss. Now, I think in the original bond, I haven't checked and I apologize, it does use the language directly. So for some reason, Cincinnati took that out of the bond. The other thing they took out of the bond is this original requirement. So for Mr. Peters to say, well, if it's so important, they should have gotten the original document, the bond doesn't require the original document, and a carbon copy is an original. And in fact, it's not stated in the briefs, because this is the first time they've really brought the issue back up again. The Wisconsin Department of Motor Vehicles requires that Mr. Kust either have an original or a carbon duplicate on file. We always accepted the carbon duplicates. There's nothing wrong with accepting the carbon duplicates.
What steps did the bank take after it first discovered that Westown had not perfected its security interest in the vehicles?
You mean through the MV1s or through... I'm sorry, I just don't understand.
What I'm trying to figure out is, is if there's evidence in the record as to how many leased vehicles lacked insurance or a perfected lien.
Yes. There is evidence in the record. I believe that is cited. I do recall it being cited in summary judgment, at least. I don't recall whether it was in the appellate briefs or not. I don't know the number off the top of my head. But again, when that first came up, whenever we would get an MV1 or if something was rejected by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, there would certainly be a call to Mr. Kust, there is an error here. And Mr. Kust would say, I will correct it. And usually we would get a corrected MV1 in the mail, or there would be something supposed to be put into the file that was corrected. The other issue is not only is this good faith in the ordinary course of business, but there was a forgery. And again, Cincinnati has admitted they don't disagree with...
Well, but short of intentional collusion in fraud, what would be an example of a bank not acting in good faith or the ordinary course of business?
Well, I think those are two separate standards, Judge Rovner. Good faith requires that the bank... I think certainly a collusional argument or something along those lines where the bank is complicit in the fraud. Wink, wink. So, for example, I don't remember which case it was, but one of the cases off the top of my head, I think it was Reliance Bank Shares, where the bank knew that the borrower did not own specific property. He went ahead and he put a mortgage on property,
right,
and he wasn't an officer. That's clearly not good faith.
Cincinnati has never argued that there was complicity here.
They've never argued complicity, but it wasn't until their 30B6 deposition that they admitted the bank said, quote, or acted in good faith. And, I mean, they're still trying to get around that, saying that there's some normative requirement. With regards to the second part of your question, the usual course of business, again, there are no cases dealing with bonds that talk about the usual course of business. That's something that Cincinnati added. If we go to a normative standard, which Cincinnati wants, yes, I think that creates an issue of fact. But I think if you do that, what you've done is you've punished the bank after the fact for Cincinnati to say, oh, now that we think about it, yes, the usual course of business means this. You should have done these things, and we're going to deny it, and we should have a trial on it. Well, not after the fact, not when they've changed the language, because you construe it against them. If it was so important to Cincinnati, why didn't they put that in there? The usual course of business, again, what does a bank do? If this were the case and Mr. Kust came in and said, I have a Mona Lisa and I want to borrow $1 million, does a bank normally loan money on works of art or a Monet, anything you can imagine? Or is it a fake? Well, the bank certainly is not in the business of borrowing or loaning money on works of art. They wouldn't know. They couldn't tell you the value of that work of art. They couldn't, they'd have to have appraisals, they'd have to have experts. That's not what a bank does. But here, all this was is a commercial transaction. Mr. Koos would go and either sell or loan on a vehicle, and he would come to the bank and say, I would like you to fund this transaction. And the bank, when Mr. Koos would call or fax in the information, the fake information, the bank would say, yes, we can fund that transaction. Bring it in. Now, the loan itself wasn't approved until all the documents are signed, but the bank said, yes, we can do this deal. And that makes sense, because obviously if Mr. Koost was some other automotive enterprise, you don't want to get in a situation where you're loaning a ton of money and a bank is making decisions 2-3 weeks later. But he would call the bank, here's the information. They would say, if X, Y, and Z, you bring in the loan documentation, we will fund that deal. And that's what they did. And in fact, there were situations where they would not fund a transaction. There were situations where if Mr. Koost had incorrect information, or even on the phone or through the fax, they would say, you know what, the residual rate is too high, or we think the length of the lease is too high, or the value of that vehicle based on the blue or black book is incorrect. And Mr. Koos would have to rearrange the deal with his customer, or so we thought. So it wasn't a situation of a rubber stamp on behalf of the bank. Finally, I'd like to turn to the issue of the 12% interest. We believe Judge Griesbach was correct in all aspects, but with respect to Judge Griesbach, we disagree on regards to the 12% and the rationale of that 12% interest. An insurance company, when presented with a proof of loss under WIS Stats 62846, has a decision to make, and 30 days. Do we pay this loss, or do we deny it and take a risk? It's a simple transaction, yes or no. Now, the language says reasonable proof. In this case, there is no reasonable proof. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin hasn't really enunciated a strong standard of what reasonable proof is. But in this case, the only thing Cincinnati had, their 30B6, that I had two things. First, I relied on the expert, Tim Finn. And I said, well, Mr. Armantrout, Mr. Finn stated he hadn't been retained until 2 years after the loss. How could you have relied on him? Well, then I relied on counsel, outside counsel, Mr. Peters. And if that's all it takes, is an outside lawyer saying you don't owe the money to give an insurance company reasonable proof, you've basically made the entire language of 62846 superfluous, because there was no reasonable proof. In this case, Cincinnati knew or should have known, one, there's no requirement for direct loss. Two, Cincinnati knew or should have known there was no requirement for original. Three, Cincinnati knew or should have known that all that was required is that there be a forgery, a loan, and a loss.
So you would certainly not agree that the issue of whether Agreement E affords coverage is close.
No. I bet a steak dinner on this at the beginning of the case that it wasn't close.
Oh, dear.
So, no, I disagree. And the point of the
Who'd
fact is...
Who'd you make that bet with?
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Who'd you make the bet with?
Chuck Graupner. My office.
Oh, you didn't make it with...
No, I did not make it. But I did make arrangements before we filed suit for Mr. Koost. He waived his Fifth Amendment rights to sit in my office and to give testimony, to answer any question that Mr. Peters wanted. And in fact, not only did Mr. Peters depose him, I think it was about 4 hours, he also submitted an affidavit for Mr. Koost to fill out and attest to every single one of the loans being a forgery, every single one of the loans being false, you know, all the facts here. Again, Cincinnati knew that before the lawsuit was even commenced, and they knew that after we filed the proof of loss, but before they completely denied the claim. They knew these facts. How often does a criminal defendant waive Fifth Amendment rights before they've even been charged by the U.S. Attorney's Office to give that testimony? Mr. Koos gave in, wanted to atone for what he had done, and he told Cincinnati everything they wanted to know. If there was anything they wanted to know, they could have asked. And if there's anything that Mr. Peters says, well, we don't know that answer. Well, because he didn't ask the question, but he was made available. Mr. Koost was made available. So we would ask that the court affirm Judge Griesbach in all respects. However, we would ask that the court remand solely on the issue of the 12% interest from the time of the proof of loss to the time that the offer of judgment was made to Cincinnati, because the bank is allowed to recover that 12% interest under 628 46.
Before you sit down on that yes. issue of the statutory interest in the insurance code, how should the reasonable proof language be interpreted when the threshold dispute is really a legal one? Because here, I mean, there's a factual dispute only if the threshold legal issue of the insuring agreement's language in good faith and in the usual course of business is resolved in the insurer's favor. And so we've got really a, you know, sort of a hybrid here where the issue is initially a legal one and then, depending on how that issue is resolved, a factual one requiring reasonable proof. But the statute only speaks to reasonable proof of the claim.
Sure. And there are two answers, Judge Sykes, and let me tell you why there's two answers. One is specifically factual to this case, and one is an overarching. Specifically factual to this case, at any time up to Judge Griesbach awarding summary judgment to Cincinnati or to First National, Cincinnati could have turned around and said, you know what, we'll pay the claim. We'll pay the claim. Since the bank would have taken that money, obviously they don't have to go the risks of summary judgment. So Cincinnati, at all stages of the game, even after First National filed its summary judgment brief, could have made that determination. You know, you're right. That usual course of business language, that's not in the standard bond. It doesn't require an original. We're wrong. They could have made that choice. Overarching, what reasonable basis really means is when you look to an insurance policy, A, did the insurance company even indemnify or agree to provide cover that risk? In the case, it comes up often, for example, in the environmental insurance context, where an insurance company say, you know what, during the time of the loss, we were not the insurer. That's a reasonable basis. Or the named insured or the persons, we don't cover them or we have a specific exclusion. They don't have that. In fact, what Cincinnati to this day has still done is said exclusion H, which talks about losses caused by employee, well, that's applicable because the bank's employees were involved. Well, of course they're involved. You have to act through your employees. Cincinnati does not say that the bank was complicit or that the employee caused the loss, but they're using H just as make weight. That's not a reasonable basis. You know, exclusion E and insuring agreement E, you've got to view those. Insuring agreement you view broadly, exclusion you view narrowly. And Cincinnati has done what a number of those other courts has articulated best by Pine Bluff and reversed them. And they've basically made the exclusion E supra over the insuring agreement. And that's not the case. You view broadly for the insuring language, narrowly for the exclusion. And under the narrow exclusion, E does not apply because it specifically says if covered under A, D, or E insuring agreements. We move both under D and E. And the reason we don't need to get to the issue of D, and Judge Griesbach did not need to get to that issue, is because the forgery is so clear. There was no dispute that the forgery itself was caused. We don't even need to reach the issue of counterfeit because it's forgery or counterfeit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haid. 2 minutes.
I'll be brief because I'm on gratuitous time, I understand. But a couple of comments I'd like to respond to. One, this bond was a current bond at the time. There's nothing unusual about this bond language. There was no endorsement on this bond. This was the standard form Cincinnati bond. This bond and the language, including the language dealing with good faith and usual course, was addressed in Georgia Bank and Trust versus Cincinnati Insurance Company, which addressed this very bond. In addition, it was in National Liberty Bank versus Aetna, which addressed the Aetna bond, had the same language in it. This is current language at the time.
Well, I guess perhaps you're misunderstanding the question that I asked earlier, which is to say that the bond that's in use and is the model bond is the financial institutions bond, which doesn't contain this language about the usual course of business. That's peculiar to the Cincinnati bond and perhaps the... Yeah. Liberty Mutual bond as well, but
I was not meaning to take exception to your question. I tried to address it as best I could. What I was taking exception to was the comment by counsel that this is some kind of crazy bond that Cincinnati only has this language, when at the time that's not the case.
But it is not the model bond. It's got additional language that Cincinnati
hasn't. Is it the current model bond? I don't believe it is exactly the current model bond. That is correct. Second issue I'd like to address real quickly is the comments by counsel that every time someone asked Lee Cust, he corrected the issue. That's not the case. The record is clear that they asked Lee Cust why the MV1s are wrong, and he said, oh, I'll look into it, and no one ever followed up on it. As a matter of fact, the record is clear that in 98 of the 160 loans that were outstanding at the time this thing was discovered, 98 of the 160 didn't even have a MV1 in it at all.
All of those factual issues matter only if your interpretation of the usual course of business is the correct interpretation of that language. And if it was meant to be a normative standard equating essentially to negligence, wouldn't it have been stated differently, such as in a commercially reasonable fashion or with the reasonable due diligence by the bank or words of that nature?
Well, again, I think you have to realize this language was not just insurance company language. This was a joint effort. And I think that you have to read...
Well, that goes back to the point that my earlier questions about whether this is actually standard bond language, model bond language or not.
At the time, it was.
I'm not sure that is borne out. And perhaps you can address that.
Well, it was never in the briefs that were filed, there was never dispute that this bond would not be interpreted against Cincinnati, that it, because it was a joint effort, that it would be interpreted according to the intended meaning of it. That's never been a dispute until today. So, I can't address that specifically with you. If you would like a supplemental brief, I'm sure we can do that. But
we'll let you know.
Okay, I didn't mean to suggest. The other issue is that there was a quick recognition by the bank that this was a problem. They did make one or two phone calls to people and found out there was no lease. They even cross-referenced their own records. They could tell from their own records that an automobile that was in their floor planning was also leased to somebody, and in several situations that the same vehicle is leased to two different people in their own records. So it was a simple thing for the bank to find out, and that is what supports our argument that we should have had our day in court on that issue. Thank you for allowing me to go slightly over.
And thank you very much. Case will be taken under advisement.